Welcome to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio, bringing you insights and strategies to help you create a magnificent and fulfilling second half of life. Here's your host, certified professional retirement coach and best-selling author, Dr. Dorian Mincer.
I want to welcome everybody today to my series, Revolutionize Your Retirement, interviews with experts to help you create a fulfilling second half of life. I'm Dorian Mincer, and I'm really delighted that you're all here today. I am totally delighted that we have Vicki Kind with us. Vicki, as many of you read it when you signed up, Vicki is a clinical bioethicist, a medical educator, and a hospice volunteer. Her award-winning book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision-Making, Making Choices for Those Who Can't, guides families and professionals through the difficult process of making decisions for those who have lost capacity. Vicki's an honorary board member of the Well Spouse Association and has been a caregiver for many years for four of her family members. She provides bioethics consultation and support for many hospitals in the Los Angeles area and holds a master's degree in bioethics from the Medical College of Wisconsin and a bachelor's degree in speech communication from California State University at Northridge. She specialized training in mediation and cultural negotiation from Pepperdine University and UCLA, and she's a wonderful resource. Before the end of the call, and I think many of you have already seen her website, I really encourage you to go to Vicki's website, kindethics.com, and also sign up for her blog, because she keeps people informed of many very important things. And today her focus is going to be on helping caregivers accept help. And caregiving is such an important role that we have now that we're all living longer and there's more long-term terminal illness as well as long-term chronic illness, and we all know about Alzheimer's and dementia. Vicki, I'd love to have you start, and maybe you can explain what a bioethicist is, because I think some people probably don't even know what that is. So perhaps you can tell us a little about that.
Thank you for having me on today. This is such an important topic for me to be able to speak about, so thank you. Most people don't know what a bioethicist is. It's an invisible profession. There are actually two kinds of bioethicists. They're the type that work in the hospital setting, helping make sure that patients' rights are being respected and that there's good communication, and we bring both health law and ethical principles and help people facilitate hard decisions. There are some people who are bioethicists in the research area. That's not what I do, but there are people that stand by and watch and evaluate research projects. Should we be experimenting on someone with Alzheimer's who can't really give us informed consent? Can we research this medicine on children? What are we doing? Are we doing this well? You'll find people in my field going into one direction or other. My expertise is helping people at the bedside, helping that family who's standing there saying, I don't know what to do. Grandma didn't tell me what to do. Or the doctors call me and say, this family is crazy. I don't know how to help them. Or this patient isn't listening. That's what I do.
Oh, that's great. It's an area just, it's so needed. And one of the things I know you had explained to me when I was talking with you not long ago, Vicki, was that hospitals have bioethicists that are part of hospitals, and nursing homes have ombudsmen, so that there's so many areas that bioethicists can be available for people.
Absolutely. And we all are entitled to use the bioethics committee at the hospital. So if you're in a situation or your client is in a situation where you're like, this is not right, and you're getting angry or your gut's just killing you, you can actually call the hospital operator and say, I want to talk to someone from your ethics committee or your bioethics committee. And they're supposed to connect you to that person, or they'll at least call you back. And then that person can help you navigate the problem and can connect you to the right resources. They're really a wonderful resource that's available to all people.
That's really helpful for all of us to know. I wish I had known that back when I was dealing with my mother. I know you and I had spoken about that. But I also know that your caregiving journey began when you were, like, I think 21, and your mom had a stroke. So you were really young to have to start taking care of someone. Would you be willing to share a little about that experience? Because I'm sure that's influenced the role that you're taking now with people and really talk about what that was like both at your age and really what was the hardest part of caregiving for you.
Oh, yeah. I'm 49 now, so this was a while ago, but I was 21. My mom had a massive stroke. She and I worked in our own family business, so not only did I become a caregiver at 21, I became fully in charge of our family business, and I was trying to balance running the business, caring for her in a critical condition, and then managing her long-term care needs. Some things that really did not help me is that back then we didn't have all the resources. We didn't have the Stroke Association. We didn't have the internet. We didn't have all the things that I could have turned to, and I could have looked for answers and support. But I see a lot of caregivers, even though we have things like that, they're not looking for answers, so they're getting really burnt out. I also got terrible caregiver burnout. I got to the point where I just almost, I guess I had such a depression that I couldn't even get out of bed. It was just like, I'm dying here. Because I would literally go and sleep at the hospital at night with her because she was not an easy patient. She would be one of those patients that the nurses wouldn't want to go in their room. And because she was miserable. And so I would be there to make sure that she got good care during the night, but then I'd try to be working all day, and that was really hard. I also felt really alone because all my other friends were off at college, and nobody else my age was going through this. There's actually a lot of young caregivers. There's actually an association for them. There's a lot of people who are 12, 13, 14, who are the full-time caregiver at home, and we don't know this. And they're really, this is changing their life. I think the other thing that really changed my destiny about this, though, is that I was so frustrated because the doctors would not honor my mom's wishes. My mom had made it very explicit instructions about what she would or not want to do if she was in a certain kind of condition. And the doctors never even said to me, what would your mom say? What would your mom want to do? And back then, I didn't know about bioethics. I didn't know how to be a good advocate. And I realized that my mom was living the rules and the values of the doctor. The doctor's religious values were being imposed on my mom, and they were different religions. And that always bothered me. And years later, I found out there's a profession where you can advocate for people's rights and wishes to be honored. And I think that's why I do what I do.
Certainly sounds like it. What you say really resonates. I went through a similar experience with my mother and had to, and she was very clear of what she wanted and what quality of life was and made me promise certain things. And her doctor, similar to what you're describing, also, he had said, we can keep her alive for the next year on transfusions once a month. She can be in a nursing home. And I knew that's not how my mother wanted to live her life. And I didn't know about this bioethics committee. And I just went behind his back and got hospice. And she was discharged and she was ready to die. And with hospice helped and supported us. And she died 3 days later in her own bed in her, what was her home then, in the assisted living facility. And I'm so impressed that there are people now in the role that you're in and just here, it's so difficult. And I know later in life you had to take care of your dad too. Was it a similar or different experience from when you were taking care of your mom?
I think a lot of it was different. He was easier to take care of, so that always makes things easier. But I was in my 30s by then. I've also started working in my profession as a bioethicist, and he had vascular dementia, and so he had a lot of care needs, but he also had more financial resources. He'd lived very frugally, so we had a little bit more money at that time to care for him, so that helped. But I think what I really discovered is that I started using the tools that I use in my profession, my bioethical strategies, I just started naturally using those with him. My dad's vascular dementia really fluctuated. Sometimes he'd be mentally like a 5-year-old, sometimes like a 12-year-old, sometimes he'd be completely disoriented. And I started using this tool where you adjust how much he's included in his decisions, what kind of decisions based on his mental abilities. You give him power and control when you can, but then you take over when he's not able. And I realized this is really making this easier because I knew how to protect him and empower him at the same time. I felt really good about that.
And those are part of the tools that you make available on your website, I think, too, of just how to make those decisions. I know I've heard you speak, and
yeah.
I remember being so impressed with the judgment calls and how you really help caregivers assess how to make those kind of decisions, because it's really hard to do that.
It's also listed in my book. I go through it step by step. My book is in almost every library, so people can just get a copy that way.
Great. That's really helpful. It just occurred to me, too. I just saw a movie last night. Have you seen Amour?
Yes. Yet? Yes, I have.
I really recommend. It's very hard. It's a beautiful film and a very difficult film in some ways, too, to see. But it's really about all of this. It's a couple in their later stages. You've seen it, so maybe you could talk a little about it.
Yeah, I have to say I cried a lot in it because it felt so real to me. It actually, because the woman in the movie has a stroke, and they were so realistic about her care needs, what the husband was having to do for her, how it changed everything. Just you and I, when we need to go to the restroom, we just get up and go. But when you've had a stroke or you're the caregiver of somebody with a disability, this becomes a big production. And this movie, without throwing it in your face, they just let you witness how difficult every step of the way is. He has to cut her food. But this man is devoted to her. And so many spousal caregivers are that devoted. I'm always impressed with that population because they stand by their person. But it destroys them at the same time. It's very destructive. It's actually why I created that word called care grieving.
Mm.
Care grieving is the grief and loss you feel when you're caring for and about someone else. And even you can be care grieving from a distance. I didn't take care of my dad in my house, but every night I slept with a phone beside my pillow. I was on call 24/7. If he was in the hospital, I had to be there. And you're worried all the time, and you feel wondering, am I doing the right thing? And you can be angry, you can be sad, you can feel lonely. So many caregivers are lonely because they get isolated. And I think so many people think that why is this caregiver not just making a decision or not just answering my calls? We don't understand how worn down they are. They don't have many resources. They're exhausted from being up all night. And it's a long journey. My dear friend Carol, she has been a caregiver for her father with Alzheimer's for 18 years.
Mm.
And he's still here. 18 years of being responsible. It's changed her destiny. I think when we're working with people, we really have to give people the benefit of the doubt that this care grieving, this long-term loss and grief is affecting the person, and they're really just doing the best they can.
Mm-hmm. I know you're going to be talking more about that too. And I do really recommend this movie to people too, if you haven't gone through any of your own caregiving, because it does help you see the care grieving, the burnout that can happen with caregivers who both want to take care but can lose a sense of themselves. When should caregivers reach out for help, or what's been your experience? Because so often caregivers don't. It's like beaten to feeling like this is what I have to do, and nobody really understands and nobody can help me.
And there's a lot of different reasons people don't ask for help, and we're going to talk about my four-step process in a few minutes. But I think the first thing you have to do is acknowledge that you are a caregiver. And the way I define that is, when you start to have to drive them to the doctor, when you start to have to pick up their groceries or make sure you make sure their bills are getting paid, when you start doing some stuff that you didn't used to have to do for them, you are becoming a caregiver. And right away, you should start figuring out what resources are available in your community. The first place I always call is the Area Agency on Aging. There are places like this in every county in the United States. I would make sure if I'm not living right beside my relative, find out the phone number of the neighbors. Because if they see something, they can call you. Start researching their disease. If this person has Parkinson's, what does the future look like for people with Parkinson's? Join a support group so you can be more prepared. If they still can think for themselves, Meet with your elder law attorney. Meet with a financial advisor. Know the doctor. Get the doctors. Have the patient give you permission to speak to the doctor, that you can be their voice if they're sick. There are a lot of things people need to do, but I think the first thing is to have to realize, I am going to need help, and I cannot do this alone. I always thought I could do everything alone, that I was superwoman or something. I wasn't at all. I fell apart dramatically. But that's when we have to help caregivers build a team, get a plan in place.
That's really helpful, because I think sometimes you're so involved in it, you don't even see what cost it's having on you and just what's happening to you in your life. But before you move into the four-step process, can you talk maybe a little of the difference between when it's caregiving for a parent and when it's caregiving, say, for your spouse?
Yeah, you know what? I really appreciate you asking that, because there really are, it's the work of it, making sure they're fed, making sure they're safe. All the work is the same, but the relationships are really different. When it's a spousal caregiver, or that could be a significant other or partner,
We're
actually seeing a lot of people who are divorced who are coming back and helping their divorced wife or spouse in the dying process. A lot of times people show back up to help people. There's a lot of different losses from if you're taking care of an aging parent. When you're taking care of a spouse relationship, you're not just losing your best friend. You're not losing the memories you've had together, what you saw your future look like, your dreams are shattered. And your role starts shifting from partner, life partner, to caretaker, caregiver. And that puts a different spin on things. When you're now having to take care of all the physical needs, like in that movie, of the person, the romance goes away. And the resentment starts building from both sides. Both, I don't want you to have to do things for me. I don't want to have to do all this for you, but I still love you. But that's why I tell people to go to the Well Spouse Association. They're at wellspouse.org. Amazing group, because they understand that you're losing everything. It's different with adult children of aging parents. They're different generations, a lot mostly, and so they don't always understand the needs of someone who's 20 years older than them. And the generational issues really can be in the way, because the young caregiver is trying to hurry up and do things, and the senior may be saying, wait, slow down. There's no rush. We'll get this done. There's a lot of conflict. There's all that role conflict. There can be problems between the siblings. I love mom best. No, you were always her favorite. My favorite book that addresses that is Francine Roos, that's called They're My Parents Too. Brilliant book. If you're working with family dynamics, it's fabulous. So it's really difficult, because I see where the person, especially who's losing a parent, all of a sudden, that my parent's supposed to take care of me. And we know lots of people, especially in this younger generation, the 30-year-olds are still living at home. Mom's still doing their laundry. And for things to start changing, wait, you're supposed to be taking care of me. Now I have to take care of you. Or they're really busy because they're trying to balance raising their own kids, and now they've got to take care of mom. And there's a lot of pressure on the adult child, because they usually are still working. And I think caregiving is really hard for everyone, but there are different triggers that are going to make it difficult for each group.
That's really helpful. And it sounds like this care grieving fits into that stage too. When you were talking about that, I was reminded of another book that I recently read. That, do you know the book by Barbara Oaken and Joseph Nowinski called Saying Goodbye?
No, I don't. I'm going to write it down.
Okay, write it down.
Yeah.
I think it's terrific. What they do is, now that there's so many more kind of long-term illnesses, what they say is that sort of the stages of grief that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked about are still applicable, but more maybe sudden death, or when it's not so prolonged. But part of what you're talking about is some of these caregiving needs that occur over time. And what they come up with, five stages too, with the diagnosis often being the first crisis point. And they talk about crisis, unity, I don't have it in front of me, but there are five stages: unity, upheaval, reconciliation or resolution, and then the renewal, which often happens at time of death as people begin to move forward and celebrate life. But they frame it in terms of the fact that somebody can live, just as you were saying about your friend, 10 years with Alzheimer's or 20 years as a breast cancer survivor, but still with that sense of a time bomb, or lupus, or any situation, leukemia, where people rally and you almost die, and then you're in remission and you're alive. And so the detaching and then the reattaching and the burnout that's involved with it. So I really recommend the book because I think it dovetails some of what you're talking about.
Yeah. My aunt almost died so many times. I sat vigil with her over a year and a half, I don't know how many times. And then she'd always rally. I mean, it was so brutal. I loved her dearly, and I would always keep showing up, but it was destroying me. And so many people think of grief as something happens at the end. Or maybe you have anticipatory grief. You're grieving just those last couple months before the person dies. No, caregivers are suffering long term, and suffering could be anger, fear, resentment. It's that emotional upheaval. That's why I want people to get help. And I think most caregivers do not ask for help.
We're going to go on in a minute. There are a couple of questions that came up that I'm going to have some at the end, but if you don't mind, I'm going to ask.
Sure.
A couple now, it shifts it a little, but Betsy from New York had asked a question about bioethicists. Do all hospitals have them or only larger ones? And if you're dealing with a hospital that doesn't have someone in that role, what do you suggest?
Yeah, but mostly the bigger healthcare systems, Catholic systems, VAs, Kaiser, major universities, they'll have a bioethicist. Some smaller hospitals choose to have one like part-time. But in every hospital, there is a team of people called the Bioethics Committee, and there are a lot of people who have education. Maybe they're not a professional bioethicist, but they're trained and they're educated, and they can still help you. What you want to do is you want to ask for the ethics team or the ethics committee, and then that group, it may entail people that are expert with training like I have, and other people may just have a smaller amount of training, but they're still very helpful. You can always get some support. Smaller hospitals, they don't have the money to pay for as much benefit, but I think the people will still be able to help you.
Oh, that's good to hear. And one more before we move on, from Sylvia from St. Louis. She's really asking a question in terms of a spouse, and I think it's a really important question. She wonders, how do you handle a spouse who's questioning the positive intent of you as the caregiver? The spouse ends up being very resistant and very suspicious and doesn't let her call the doctor or demands care when she believes he could do more. If he weren't believing he was so helpful, these are some of the dynamics I think that happen in these really difficult situations. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. The two places I always break questions into is if the person still has full mental functioning and they're just really don't want you to control them and they're getting resentful. You're not the boss of me, but their mind is sharp. That's one category. I'll answer that question in a moment. There's also the category where the person is starting to deteriorate mentally, whether it's a mental illness, maybe they're getting paranoid, maybe they're starting to have dementia and confusion. How I would handle that situation would be different. So let me start with the first one. If the spouse still has their brain working pretty well, and they're just not liking that you're taking over and controlling them, what you want to do is to keep reminding yourself that you are a partner with them. You should not be taking over. So what the primary thing is, you don't want to tell them what to do. You want to ask them what they think. Now, that means that we're not always going to get our way. I like getting my way, but the reality is if the other person doesn't want to go to the doctor and their mind hasn't become fragile, that they can't protect themselves, people have a right not to go to the doctor. They have a right not to take their medicine, even though it kills us, right? We have to remember people have what they call autonomy. Now, that doesn't mean you can't get their cooperation, but by saying to them, you know what? It's been worrying me, and you talk about it, but I know it's of course your decision, but I just wanted to mention those things. By giving it back to them, telling them your concerns, and then stepping away by saying, but of course it's your decision, give them back their power and control, then a lot of times what will happen is a day later they'll say, you know what, I've been thinking, maybe I should go get that checked out. Because now they got to decide it. They're not doing it because you made them. They're doing it because it's their idea. We all like to think everything's our own idea. If that's the situation, the best book I know, and I would tell you to get it right away, is called How to Say It to Seniors by David Solie, S-O-L-I-E. He is brilliant about teaching how people to have conversations where you still give people control, but you can maybe influence them in a way that's respectful.
Hmm.
If it's the situation where the person's starting to have mental breakdown, whether it's mental illness, dementia, some other thing that's impairing their judgment, that's when I think it gets harder, because you can't have a rational conversation with somebody who's irrational. You can't convince them to do something because they're not thinking clearly. The more impaired they get, the more you must step in. They cannot protect themselves from danger. If there's a fire and they don't know to call, 911, you've got to step in and say, it's not safe. You can't live at home. We've got to get someone in the house, or we've got to have you move. Now, there's respectful ways you do that, and you go at a certain speed. But when the person becomes less able to protect themselves, that's when your power grows. Now, again, I still think you have to be aware of control issues. So maybe you give them two choices. I don't know if you ever did this with children. I see mommies go to the store and they say to the kid, what do you want to buy in the clothing store? And the kid picks all sorts of things that are inappropriate. What my mom used to do is she would say, which of these three dresses do you want? Which one do you want to pick? So she's already picked three appropriate dresses that are in her price range that are available that would be appropriate. And then I got to pick one of those three. You can do that same kind of strategy with people who still have some decision-making power. You can control their choices, but and then that way you're also controlling what they cannot choose. All right, so let me give you an example. If they do need someone living at home or they have to move somewhere, what you need to say is, if there's no choice, you need someone to help you around the house. You don't even have to say that. Just say, so here are your choices. We can get someone to live here or come in, and I don't know if you want that. You can either have someone live with you full time. You can have people that come in and go out, different shifts, or we can look at moving you to a new facility. To a new care community is the right wording right now. Don't call it facility. A new care community. Let's talk about those. Let's maybe we go look at them. Maybe you meet and interview some caregivers. But the choice, there's no choice saying you can still live home alone. So you start creating a situation where you give them choices and control, but only choices that you're comfortable with. Because they're vulnerable, and that's why we're allowed to do that, just like a small child is vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
I hope that helped.
That's excellent. Sylvia, if there's more questions with your question, just post another question, and I'll get to it a little bit later with Vicki. Maybe it would be helpful now to talk a little about what your four-step process is for helping caregivers to ask for help.
Yeah, this came to me standing in my friend's house, because I realized my friend Beth, apparently I know a lot of people who are caregivers, because I think I'm the kind of person who's a caregiver, so my friends are the kind of people who would care for others. I attract a lot of nurturing people in my life. My best friend Beth, she's been the caregiver of two children after their parents died. A daughter-in-law with cancer, two in-laws, and then her own parents, and she's down to the last one. Okay, so she's been a caregiver, I don't know, for how many years, 18, 20, 30 years. She's got the last loved one living in town with her, not in her house, her mom, and she's had a stroke, but she's pretty well functioning, but she needs some help. And there's other family members around, so it's not like Beth's all alone. And so Beth has everyone over to their house for a birthday party or one of those holiday parties. Now, who really should be having the party? Beth is a full-time caregiver, running her mom to doctor's offices and doing all this. She doesn't have time to clean the house. buy the food, prep the food. But of course, everyone in the family thinks that's what she should do. So on top of her caregiving, now Beth is supposed to be party planning. And the day of the event, there's 20 other healthy relatives at the house. Who has to go and pick up mom at the care community and bring her over? Beth. Who has to take her to the bathroom when she gets there? Beth. I just was looking at this thinking, this is ridiculous. What is wrong with all these horrible, lazy adult children? I was getting very judgmental. I stood with Beth outside the doorway of the restroom because she got her mom in there, and then we were politely standing outside while she did what she needed to. And I said, Beth, this is a great opportunity. Look at all the people here. Nobody's stressed. Everyone, we could show people what needs to be done so they could be better trained to help you. And then I started getting all of these resistance statements. They don't want to help. I don't have time to teach them. It's just easier if I do it. She wouldn't like it if other people did it. All of this resistance started flying out of her. And I realized that it's not just that those are lazy adult children. The reality is she's not even asking. She's already asked and answered in her head, they don't want to help, so I won't even bother asking. Step one of this process is that if you're a caregiver, and that could be a professional or personal, because we all need help, if you ask yourself, if somebody said, what can I do to help? Or somebody says, why aren't you asking people for help? What are those resistance statements that start popping out of your head? And there are all sorts of different ones. When I used this process with a support group, they loved it because all of a sudden they started hearing themselves. One person said, why should I have to ask? They should just know what to do. So that's step one, is write down all of the things that stop you from asking. Step two is when you try to break those resistance statements. Beside your resistance statement, maybe even in another color pen, write down something that could counteract it. The first sentence Beth said to me was, they don't want to help. She could have said, I don't know this because I haven't even given them a chance. Or, they don't know what to do. I could teach them. And that one person, this was a good one, this support group lady, she told me, she said, hers is, it's just easier if I do it. And she said, only the first time. She said, if I teach them, then they can do it the next time. It was like a light bulb went off. Everything that you want to say I can't do, you talk yourself out of it with a resistance breaker or power statement, I call it. So now all of a sudden, when that thing pops up in your head, you go to your power statement and say, but maybe I can do it differently. And this takes practice. This isn't going to just all go away right away. And I know that this helps because when I sat there at that house that day, I grabbed a couple of the son-in-laws and I said, do you know how to use a wheelchair? And they looked at me. I'm like, let me show you. And I showed them how to open it and close it, take the legs off, put the legs on, how to put on the brakes. I just showed them the basics. And they're like, I said, so now when she needs someone to push her, you'll know what to do. And they're like, great, thank you for showing me. It's not that these people weren't going to help. They didn't know how. It did not cross their mind to ask. But when I did show them, many people were willing. I grabbed some of the other nieces and nephews. I said, you are in charge of making sure grandma gets food. So go find out what she wants. And then later on, you have to check on her again. People can be trained, but we have to begin training them. And I think that's what's really hard, is because caregivers are tired and we don't want to have to train anyone or do anything. But the reality is we're tired because we don't have help, and we never will unless we put in that effort, train some other people, get some people on our team, and then we would have some time to rest. Those are the first two steps. Maybe you want to ask some questions.
Can you just maybe give some, I think you did with Beth, give examples. Why don't you go through the four and then maybe some.
Okay, sure. All right, so step number three. So the step number three is you make a ridiculously long wish list. All the things you wish people would help you with. Now, I sometimes divide them up in local versus distance versus information, or you can call it practical. or weekly things I need help with, however you want to sort it. Because there are certain things people can do for you from a distance. There are things people can do for you locally. So you make a really long list and you carry it with you everywhere, every day, all the time. Because when that person at church says to you, "Is there anything I can do to help?" you say, "How about that? I just happen to have my list right here." And you pull out the list and you hand it to her and say, "Is there anything on there you could help me with?" And you know what? That person will find something and say, "I could bring over milk and bread on Saturday for you. Is there anything else you want me to get?" They're going to find things on the list. People actually want to help us. They want to be supportive. But they don't know what we need because we can't think of it when they ask. Or maybe your brother can't help you because he lives across the country, but he can listen in on a conference call at all the doctor's appointments. So he'll understand what's happening with Dad's health and what needs to be done next. He'll become more involved because he'll be more educated. Or people can actually do your shopping online from somewhere else and have your groceries delivered. Or maybe somebody could pick up Mom and drive her to her hairdresser appointment. People actually want to help. I think that's the thing that's on caregivers. We don't think people want to help us, but they do. There are people in faith communities who are waiting to serve. There are high schoolers who need community service hours that they have to do to graduate. They need things to do. There's so much help out there, but we've got to ask. So that's step three. And the final step is ask a lot of people. Ask everyone. If you may have to ask five people to get one person to say yes. Some people would say, "Wow, five people and only one said yes." I say, five people and one person said yes, yay, that's success. You've got one person that'll help you, and I bet you they'll help you at least twice a month. So you have to ask a lot of people, but you also have to allow them to choose the things on the list that they're good at and comfortable with doing. A lot of times people want their brother, who is really uncomfortable in visiting hospitals, to be that person where maybe they would be glad to do some research on what the best automatic wheelchair is to buy. People need to choose the tasks that they're comfortable with, and then they're going to also be more willing to. Those are the four steps. We have to ask a lot of people. We have to have a list. We have to let people choose what's easiest for them, and we have to get past our resistance.
That's really helpful. And what it makes me think of, too, is, and maybe you can share a little of what your experience has been with it, but I know at the school where my son was, we've just given you an example, there was one woman who had a number of malignant tumors, and two of us created through this Lots of Helping, excuse me, lotsofhelpinghands.com, it's either .com or .org, we set up with her permission and her husband's permission, and we had him also be one of the administrators, and we were too, and we were able to ask them what are the categories of the kind of help they need, and it was taking her for appointments, it was picking up the kids, it was bringing meals, and so people could and were told that they could sign up to be part of this caring community. And I've actually mentioned it to our temple where we have a caring community, and it's often used in some situations there too. So people can look and sign, see what the needs are and see what their schedule is and sign up, and that you even can put down what the food is you're bringing so that people don't bring chicken all every day of the week. Put down, and there's another one I think called Caring Bridge.
CaringBridge.org, I think.
I think it's .org. Do you find that people are also resistant to these?
The Caring Bridge, I see a lot of people using it to translate information out to the group.
Yeah.
Because when you're in a stress mode, I remember when I was running the business when my mom was really sick, everybody in the business knew my mom. They were all worried. I would have 100 people a day asking me, "How's your mom? How's your mom? How's your mom?" And I just couldn't bear it. It was just exhausting. I put a note on the outside of the door saying, "Mom is stable. She's still in the hospital. Thanks for asking, but Vicki is really tired. Please don't ask her today." But that's the nice thing about Caring Bridge is you can send out one group mail to all the people that care and they can communicate online, but they're not bothering you with a lot of phone calls. But I love the other one you just mentioned, because truthfully, people will help. There are so many good people in the world. People will help you that you didn't even imagine would help you. It's just incredible. When I started to reach out for help after I had a breakdown, all sorts of people said, "Vicki, do you know that I have been waiting to help you? And I've always felt that our relationship is out of balance because you only help me and you never allow me to help you." People were actually resentful that I wasn't letting people help me. That blew me away.
Yeah.
I was actually harming relationships because I was not being fair and taking turns, because that's how the world's supposed to work. I help you, then you help me. It was eye-opening.
Yeah, and I found the same thing with this lotsofhelpinghands.org, that so many people feel so helpless and don't know what to do and also don't want to be intrusive by setting something up. And somebody has to step up to the plate to mention it and help set it up. But by setting it up, it gave people this opportunity to feel that they could do something, and it really created a wonderful caring community. It was terrific. I wonder, does the care grieving, do you think, get in the way?
I think so. Most people don't ask for help soon enough, and by the time they're torn apart by the process, they just don't have the strength anymore. I describe it like people are, you throw them a life vest, and they literally can't reach over and grab it. And we actually see this when people are drowning. I used to be a lifeguard. When you throw a life vest to someone who's so exhausted from being in the water and can barely stay afloat, they don't have the strength to grab the life vest. And I think that's what it is with caregivers. I'm even seeing that with healthcare professionals. Physicians are so being beat up, so much caregiver burnout and compassion fatigue, so worn out that when I go in and try to help them and give them some education to make it a little easier, they can't even reach out for help. They're so beat up. So I think that's a big problem. That's why I think we need to start supporting people sooner so they never get to that point.
That's helpful. What about, do you find that this denial gets in the way also with people sometimes helping? One person maybe really sees that, say, their parent isn't doing well and shouldn't be living alone, but then other people don't see that. They come and maybe visit less often, and that they're resistant. Does that seem to happen at times too?
You know what? I see a lot of denial, and I think a lot of denial, it's self-protection. We know that, like, when we give bad news in a hospital, a bad disease, tell you about your new disease, there's a lot of denial. People can only take in as much bad news as their brain will tolerate. If they took it all in, psychologically, it'd be like their brain exploding. So there's no judgment involved in saying people are in denial. It's a normal, healthy reaction for your body to say, wait, I don't want to take all this in. But long-term denial starts hurting the other person. So just for example, if I don't take in the information that I have a disease that needs treatment and I keep blocking it, not just for a few days, but for months, I'm never going to get the help I need. I'm never going to start the treatment. The same thing is true with families when they cannot see that mom's not safe at home anymore because she just lit the house on fire twice, or she shouldn't be driving, or she's falling all the time. When we rationalize that, we refuse to see that, it becomes very dangerous. So what I try to explain to family caregivers is that there are two kinds of denial. Short-term denial, it's fabulous. It protects our brain. It helps us for those first couple days come to terms. But long-term denial is dangerous. The person isn't kept safe. You're not getting the medical care that person needs. You're not building a team of support around you and the patient. There's so many things that aren't happening that if you stay in long-term denial, you're actually now harming your loved ones. And most good caregivers, they don't want to harm their loved ones. They're really just still self-protecting. A lot of people are like, but if I see it, then it means I'm going to have to do something. If I see it, then I have to be the grown-up. I hear so, especially with adult children, they really don't want to see it because their life is about to change. When I hear people get new bad news, I realize, oh boy, you don't know what just hit you, how much your life is going to change. I totally understand the denial. So I do teach people about short-term versus long-term. The other technique I use is something called disbelief. It's not a term we use a lot, but disbelief means you can believe something and not believe it at the same time, which is a strange thing. But you'll hear people say, I know I really should, but I don't want to, and they pull back away from it. Or, I know he has cancer, but I don't think he really has cancer. I wish we could get a second opinion, but I think he might have cancer because he's really sick, but I don't think he has it because I don't want him to have it. And they literally are bouncing back and forth between understanding and not wanting to understand. Disbelief is a fabulous place, and I actually teach people about it formally because I want them to understand that I get it. You do not want to be thinking about this 24/7. But what I need from you is for the next 15 minutes, you and I are going to have to talk about building a good plan to make sure that your grandfather is safe regarding his medicines because he's not taking them the right way. I only need to talk to you for 15 minutes. So for the next 15 minutes, could you really be with me? And then after that, I want you to take the rest of the day off and not think about it at all. Mm-hmm. It's funny. It helps the person buy in that, okay, I can deal with the stuff that's really hard, but then I'm allowed to not always be living in that hard place. And people will actually come back to me and say, you know what? I have been in denial, or I really wasn't wanting to see it. I don't mind talking about these things explicitly with people. I just introduce it. I say in a normal way. A lot of families I work with, they don't want to see what's happening. And I can understand that. Anytime I say, a lot of people, a lot of families also do this, it normalizes it and makes it safe. I'm not saying you are doing it. I'm saying a lot of people do this. So then it's okay. So then how do we help it? The other communication tool is to use an if question. If something is true, then what should we do is really the formula. So in the hospital, I might say to someone who cannot see that their loved one is dying, if Bob were to die, I'm not actually saying he is dying, so I'm keeping the disbelief there. We don't have to fully throw it in their face, even though he is dying. But I'm going to say, if he were to die, would he want to die here at the hospital or go home? The reaction I usually get will be, do you think he's dying? He'd want to come home. We'd want him home. But I don't want him to die, but do you think he's dying? And so they're starting to experience the knowledge. They're trying it on. He'd want to go home. He wouldn't want to be here. This is a terrible place. So if they're doing that, means they're starting to do that disbelief dance where they're starting to take it in. And that means they're no longer in denial, but I cannot rush them. So if she is saying he'd want to go home, I would like to quickly say, then quickly, let's get hospice and let me get the person in here and get him discharged. And I start going in my hyperspeed. That will just close her down again. So I have to help her process. And then I might say one more if question. If we were going to think about sending him home, would you like me to have someone talk to you about this today? Or maybe tomorrow you could bring the rest of the family in. So I offer the thing I wish she actually knew, but I say, if you, this was true. And then I offer two choices that I'm controlling the choices. And that way they can try on the idea. It works fabulously. It's one of the best communication sentences you can use.
That's really helpful. I do have some other questions from others, but before I get to them, I do see the time here too. What you've just been talking about when denial is an issue, and I guess there's another part of the denial part, which is when everybody around the person is understanding it, but maybe the particular patient isn't willing to see that changes need to be made. And it actually relates to a follow-up question from Sylvia from St. Louis, which is in this example that she was giving, she said it's not always paranoia, but sometimes it's creating extra work for the caregiver so that, for example, somebody needs to wear Depends but refuses to, and then the caregiver has to end up cleaning up the bedroom each time. And that's a type of resistance too. Do you have any suggestions on ways you'd handle something like that?
Yeah, that is a really common one. And I think that's why it's so frustrating, because people have the right to do things the way they want to. But when they start harming other people, like the fact that you have to clean up after him and change the sheets and do all the laundry, there's harm involved. If the person is still rational, you could say to the person, if you don't want to walk where the depends, then you're going to have to do the laundry. You're going to have to change the sheets. There has to be consequences. A person who's rational will not want to do all that work. But a lot of times, it's what does that thing represent? What does it represent to have to wear depends? It means it's embarrassing. There's shame. I actually would sit and talk with that person about what is it like to be at the place in life where you might, I'm not even going to say you have to, but you might have to wear depends. What is that like for you? Because when I help that person process there, I'm angry, I can't believe it's so embarrassing, and all the things that might come flying out of their mouth, I'm validating their real reaction to what's happened to them. I think so many times we run over our care receivers, that we're just so busy trying to get it all done and taken care of, we forget how much these decisions are affecting them. I can't imagine, personally, I am not going to be happy when I have to wear depends. I just like, really? How do you even wear those? And what do they do to that way your clothes look on you? I have strong reactions, so why wouldn't your loved one? Okay. Truthfully, I would just sit and help them process. And if they're angry, they can be angry. Don't talk them out of their emotion. If they're mad, if they're sad or embarrassed, let them be embarrassed. Don't say, you shouldn't be embarrassed. You shouldn't be mad. Tell them, I'd be mad too. I'd be embarrassed too. This is really hard. This is a hard transition. So now you're validating that this is a transition. And then maybe you can have them, when they get a lot of that emotions, all those emotions out, they might be willing to talk about, so what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Because the bed, we can't let the bed keep getting wet. We could buy a plastic pad for under the bed. Okay, that's one option. And then start thinking of some options and help that person be a part of the conversation. If it's somebody that has like dementia and won't keep them on, I would call the 1-800 number for the Alzheimer's Association, because literally they have brilliant social workers with master's degrees sitting at the Alzheimer's Association answering questions morning, noon, and night, 24 hours a day. And they can tell you how to keep the pants on of somebody at 2 a.m. Their number is 800-272-3900. They are phenomenal. Any weird behavior that you aren't able to navigate with a person, just call them. They have the answers, and you can call them anytime. They're fabulous.
That's great to know of. Just a couple more questions, because I do see we're toward the end. Can you just talk a little, and it's hard because it's a big area, but you've mentioned, and we've talked a little now about when there's denial. What have you seen about how guilt gets in the way of the families who have to really make end-of-life decisions for loved ones where it hasn't been something that's been discussed? How do caregivers get past their guilt so that they can do what they need to do for their loved one?
Yeah, it's a big challenge, because most of the families I work with, the patient can't protect themselves or speak for themselves because they're really sick. So now the family has to make the decision. And the family brings all of their unresolved stuff into that hospital room. I haven't visited. I've been a bad daughter. I feel so guilty. So that person will say to me, you've got to keep him alive. I don't care what you do. You've got to get him out of that coma so I can repair my relationship with him, is what they're saying to me. Or I feel so guilty because I didn't take care of him well here in town. I should have seen that he was falling, and now he's fallen. And so people have all this guilt about either what they actually did wrong or what they perceive they might have done wrong. So here's my guilt conversation. I tell people there are two kinds of guilt, appropriate guilt and inappropriate guilt. People say to me, what do you mean, Vicki? I say, if we're thinking about what you just told me, that you feel like you haven't been a good daughter, did you actually do something wrong, or do you just feel badly? Most caregivers are actually pretty wonderful. So probably this daughter is going to say, I feel like I should have done more. I actually was a pretty good caregiver, but I always felt like there was more I could do. Then I tell them that if there you actually did something wrong. If she says, yes, I have been a bad caregiver, I am actually, there's something to be guilty for, then I tell them, you need to own up, you need to say I'm sorry, and you need to make it right. And go talk to your mom. Even if she's unconscious, tell her you're sorry. Tell her you wish it was different. But mostly it's caregivers feeling in their gut like I should have done more. I feel guilty for not being superhero caregiver. So I, with those people, I say, you're not actually guilty. It's the wrong word. You're feeling like you're wishing it was different. You regret that it's changed so much. And the same feeling of wishing it was different or feeling badly about it hits our gut in the same place that guilt does. And that's why we feel it as guilt. But it isn't guilt. You haven't done anything wrong. You have been a good daughter. You have visited. You can't do more than you can. You've done a good job. So you can't use the word guilt. You may still feel badly because we all wish we'd visited more, but you're not guilty for anything. So I try to help them understand that most caregivers, this guilt that they feel is actually inappropriate. They're just feeling badly. And that is just something for people to work through. But at least it doesn't have that loaded word called guilt. That's how I describe people that.
That's really helpful. Just a couple, there are a few other questions, and we're just going to have you come back again.
Yeah. No problem.
To continue. But Jerry from Boston has mentioned something, which that
great.
She's in a caregiver support group, and she said that humor is just so important, that she just, her comment is, we couldn't survive without seeing the human and humor of the absurdity of some of the situations that we or our loved ones are facing. And I think humor just is a way to help people stay grounded. It's really helpful.
Absolutely.
And important.
Absolutely, because we get into the most ridiculous positions, physically,
right.
Emotionally, mentally,
right.
And you just, it's like, are you kidding? I never thought I'd be doing this. And
right.
It is funny. And that's one of the great things about the support group system. Thank
right.
you for bringing that up. Support groups are wonderful because you can talk to people who get it, who
right.
have also realized they forgot to bring the Depends, and they're out at lunch, and it's, oh my gosh, what do I do? You know, I mean, we've all had our moments, and the amazing ways we solve things can be just silly and fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think support groups are imperative for caregivers.
Great. And another question is just what Betsy from New York actually said that she loves your suggestion about the wish list, but what if you want to recruit somebody else to help in the effort, or that you need to really get someone else to take lead in doing it? Do you have any little tips on how to delegate that?
You know what? I think that's great. I think that I didn't even think of that before. I think you have to still come up with most of what needs to be done, because nobody knows what's happening inside your house and the care needs of your person. But once you have a flavor of the needs that might need to be done, I need someone to mow my lawn. I need someone to pay for me to have 4 hours of in-home care so I can go to my doctor's, whatever it is. Then I think you could hand your wish list to someone else and say, could you help me find people? Or they could set up a website like you were speaking about.
Right.
I actually think that might be a brilliant idea, because it is still hard to manage and coordinate all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe if you have someone, ask the person you know that loves to be organized, that loves to be in charge. People that like those things, they'll have no problem being in charge of you too. And that's great. You want people to help you. Yeah, absolutely. Have someone else facilitate it for you. I think that's a great idea. Again, ask the right person for the right thing. The person who's irresponsible, don't give them the list. The person who likes to control, give them the list. One thing that I actually asked my brother to do when I was very low after one of my breakdowns is I told him, you have to call me every day. And I knew of the three brothers that he would actually call me every day. And he did. This went on for a couple months because I just didn't feel safe and stable. I just felt so bad that after about 2 months, I then said, now you can call me every other day. And then a couple weeks later, I said, okay, we can go back to our once a week call. I'm okay now. Even little things like that, we wouldn't stay on the phone very long. He would just call and say, are you okay? I'm thinking of you. Do you need to talk to me? Man, that literally saved me.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just 10 minutes out of his day that he saved my life.
That's another, just the need for the support of other people who don't really always know what you're going through without you being able to again, tell them what you are, what you're experiencing, and the help that you need as the caregiver. There's one other question, which I think we're going to have you come back to, but I just want to mention it and see if you have just a quick thought, and then we're going to just pull everything together. Bruce from Sharon brings up a really important point, and it's probably a whole other area, but you might have a kind of off the top of your head thought about it. But he mentions that with chronic diseases rising among the boomers who are also living longer, and as the population of children are declining, it appears as if the U.S. is entering into a full-blown caregiving crisis. And he wonders, what's the future of caregiving? Are we going to have greater dependence on immigrant caregivers? What kind of policies are needed? It's a whole topic. But
I don't usually know the global fixes. I completely agree that we have a global issue coming. I actually think immigrant caregivers or unskilled, because people that don't have other fancy college degrees, we are going to be relying on those people, and we need to pay them enough. People that care for our loved ones, it's a hard job. So I think we need to make sure the salaries are good for whoever is taking care of our loved ones. We will not have enough people. We know that we will not have enough nursing homes, assisted livings. And then even if we have enough, who has the money to spend $8,000 a month for anybody that needs a certain amount of care? Who has that money? I have long-term care insurance because I watched these kinds of issues devastate our family. I think the other issue is that our young people are sick too. Our diabetes and obesity rates and all of the other things that are happening to people in their 20s, people have high blood pressure in their childhood. So we may not even have healthy people. So I think this is going to be huge. I think that they call it the tsunami, but I think it's much greater than anyone realizes. If you want to look at some interesting studies, type in MetLife and the word caregiver. Oh, my gosh, the numbers of how this is going to be affecting businesses, because people are going to have to quit work to go home and care for people. People are the health costs to the caregivers themselves. Caregivers are dying before their care receivers because it's such a brutal process. Mm-hmm. This is going to have to be addressed, but I don't actually know who's going to address it or how it's going to get fixed. I'm not very hopeful. I think we're going to have to learn to take care of our own and really go back to a community-based process where we take care of each other's.
Maybe
I'll watch your loved one for 2 days at my house with my loved one, and then we'll trade off.
Mm-hmm.
I think we'll maybe have a co-op. I don't know if that's the right word, or daycare, shared daycares.
Yeah. No, that's excellent. Also, I need to clarify that Jerry in Boston is a guy, not a, I think I was implying that, and it's true that more caregivers are women, but
the numbers are 60-40. 40% of men, of the caregivers are men. That's a huge number. I never discount men. My brothers have been amazing caregivers in our family and with their own extended families, with people they were married to. Men are amazing caregivers, and I really think that they often get discounted, and I don't think that's okay.
That's true. All right, I'm going to ask one more, since it's one more question, and we'll pull it together. Mary from California just has commented that your discussion of the process of discussing options is so helpful. She's dealing with her husband who has early-stage Parkinson's, and she's seeing and just learning a lot from what you're talking about of ways to validate the disease being his and finding ways to introduce options that she's comfortable with. She just wonders if you could comment on what do you recommend for someone like herself who's dealing with the anger, frustration that comes from her husband's unwillingness to be proactive. So she wants him to be more proactive. And so do you have any thoughts on just how to handle those kind of feelings as the caregiver?
Yeah, I totally respect and honor what you're feeling. I think a lot of the diseases, they actually disempower the patient. I don't know if that occurs with Parkinson's. I think it might. I know with stroke, depression and an inability to get going yourself and getting reengaged and getting better yourself is a big factor. So a couple things I would recommend, besides maybe you actually need to go to a caregiver support group for yourself or get some therapy support, because what you're doing is really hard and it's going to be a long journey. That's one reason I want people to get support now before it gets worse. I would encourage you to join a Parkinson's support group. There are different Parkinson's associations out there, because those people have wisdom. They've seen the journey. They know what might be coming next. They have all sorts of ideas of what worked for them. You'll probably get tremendous ideas and resources in those groups, so I would really recommend that. I know in the Well Spouse Association, there are a lot of people doing long-term caregiving for spouses with Parkinson's. And I hear this issue come up with lots of diseases. My wife won't do. My husband won't do. It's a really common. On the spouse site, they actually have an online forum chat room where people can ask questions from each other. How do you handle this? How do you do this? It's fabulous. I would encourage you to do that. Also, they have online phone call support groups once a month, Well Spouse does. They also have group meetings in different parts of the country. Because I think that's the thing that I was so arrogant as a caregiver, since I thought I knew it all. I didn't ask for help. I burned out because I didn't ask. I thought I knew everything. I didn't do my research. I can't believe, looking back, how much I didn't realize how much I needed others. I think this is when you need to build your team. Be respectful of your husband, because it is still his journey. But I still think you can say to him, you know what? If we're married, we're a team. You can pull the wife card, too, and say, it's not okay with me. You have to share your part of this. But I really think spouse is the place to go for you, because you'll hear how other people are handling naughty spouses. It's hard to be sick.
Vicki, this was fabulous. I encourage everybody else to buy your book, The Caregiver's Path to Compassionate Decision, Making Decisions for Those Who Can't. And I want people to check out Vicki's email is vicki@kindethics.com. I think it's such a wonderful name, Vicki, kindethics.com.
It's spelled V-I-K-I.
V-I-K-I, right. Yeah, thanks. At kindethics.com. And then her website is www.kindethics.com. And the book website is www.thecaregiverspath.com. Plural, caregiverspath.com. And as I mentioned at the beginning, Vicki has just incredible resources and blogs, and you have a chat forum too, I think, don't you?
Yeah, I do. Not a lot of people use it, unfortunately, but these people, feel free to contact me directly. I'm actually very helpful. Okay. I am kind, and I would
you
be glad to respond to you. Not a problem.
And this was just wonderful. I appreciate it so much, and I hope that we can continue some of these conversations. And I want to thank everybody for being part of this call. Vicki, any last-minute little thought or comment that you want to make as the final kind of takeaway for people?
This is completely off topic, but if you have a good doctor, write them a thank you note. We will not be able to keep our good doctors because of the way healthcare is breaking apart for lots of different reasons. If you have a good doctor, thank them, bring them cookies, tell them that they still matter.
Sounds like some very helpful advice. Thank you. Thank you again. This was wonderful. Thanks again, and see you all next month. Have a good month. Take care.
You've been listening to Revolutionize Your Retirement Radio with Dr. Dorian Mintzer. To learn more about the resources mentioned on today's show, listen to past episodes, or download our free retirement transition guide, visit revolutionizeyourretirementradio.com.